Molly Ringwald will always be 16 years old for fans of The Breakfast Club, 16 Candles, and Pretty in Pink, but it's been 25 years since she acted in her last John Hughes movie, and although she's looking fabulous, she's not a teenager anymore. In fact, Ms. Ringwald recently celebrated her 40th birthday, I guess 42 now, right?
42, that's right.
And she marked the occasion by writing a book that's part memoir, part fashion guide. It's called Getting the Pretty Back, published by It Books, an imprint of HarperCollins. I'm very pleased that it brings Molly Ringwald to our show today. Hi.
Hi.
Several actresses have told me that turning 40 was traumatic. Did it feel that way for you?
It was traumatic leading up to it, which is when I got the idea to write the book, because I've always been a somewhat bookish person and have turned to books to find solace or inspiration. And I really didn't find that there was anything that kind of hit the spot. I didn't want to read something that was kind of dour and self-helpy. I wanted to read something colorful and sexy and funny, and I couldn't find it. So then I thought, well, why not just write it?
Well, you put a sexy photograph on the cover. You're in a rather come-hither pose on the cover, and although it's quite discreet, it does look like you're not wearing anything under the fabric that's draped over you.
Well, it was sort of my nod to Marilyn Monroe, those famous photographs of her that I never really realized that they were not zipped up on the side. So when they brought those dresses in, I thought, oh, well, why not do a Marilyn?
Isn't it harder to get starring roles when you're past 40, unless you're Meryl Streep?
Well, that's what everybody says. I mean, that's the conventional wisdom. But, you know, so far, so good for me. You know, I'm doing a television show right now and
playing the
mom.
Mother of a teenager.
That's right. Exactly. That happened all around the same time that I was turning 40. I was offered this part, and I thought it was pretty funny to go from being so well-known as a teenager to playing a mother of a teenager. It sort of felt like there were some steps that were sort of skipped in
there
between.
There also seems to be a bit of irony in the title, The Secret Life of the American Teenager, because for so many people, you were the American teenager, at least for a time. Have all the young actors on the show seen your movies?
I think so, yeah. I mean, it's kind of hard not to grow up in America and not see those movies. They're sort of a touchstone for so many people.
Well, many of our listeners probably saw you on TV in March at the Academy Awards ceremony. You helped present a tribute for John Hughes, who died suddenly of a heart attack in August. You wore a striking purple dress that evening. Did you feel no obligation to wear pink?
No, I did not feel any obligation to wear pink. Pink is pretty much reserved for my 6-year-old daughter now. She really likes the color fuchsia. No, I wanted to wear something, you know, I was doing a tribute. It's very exciting to be at the Academy Awards, but at the same time, I was there for, it was very bittersweet as well.
Well, when you were 16, did you like to wear pink? Or
I did.
Was that just part of your movie persona?
No, I loved pink.
And pink is good color for someone who has red hair, and you have red hair.
Not bad. That's what they say. You can wear pink and green. I wore a lot of pink.
You write in the book that women look best as they age if they keep their hair the same color that they had when they were 5 years old. Now, a lot of people's hair changes after they're five.
This is true. I have sort of a philosophy that if you stay in that sort of color range, it's very hard to get that color back. But if you kind of don't veer too far out of that. You know, I've always looked good when I've had red in my hair, because that's the kind of color I had, sort of auburn hair when I was that age.
Because it matches with your complexion?
I think so, yeah.
So is it safe to assume that you were a redhead from birth?
I was sort of, yeah, honey-colored, auburn-colored. I mean, I've been various shades of red my whole life, but I look pretty good if I stay in that realm.
What happened when you were a platinum blonde in one of your movie roles?
I write about it in the book, actually. I got a lot more attention, but it wasn't exactly the attention that I desired. It was sort of a weird feeling of feeling like getting a lot of attention at the same time sort of being invisible, because I felt like it was not my personality. I had people talking a lot slower, a lot louder.
Because they thought you were platinum blondes aren't necessarily stupid.
No, of course they're not. But there's that cliche, you know, just like redheads are supposed to be fiery and temperamental, and you know, and dark haired people are supposed to be deep and intelligent.
I've always wondered what happens when an actor looks in the mirror and sees somebody in a different hair color or with some prosthetic device. Do you just immediately slip into the character you're playing, or do you say, "Gee, this is strange. That's not me."
I think all actors are different. You know, there's a lot of actors, you know, I guess so-called method actors who just stay in character. If they're playing a part with a particular accent, they'll keep it all the time until they finish. And I've never been that kind of an actor. It's always been very important to me to make a difference and a distinction between the characters that I play in my real life. So.
You wrote a eulogy for John Hughes that was published in the New York Times shortly after his death, and in it you credited him with, catapulting you from obscurity and planting you in the American consciousness. How did you meet?
We met just in a very conventional way. You know, he had just gone to ICM agency, and I was a client of ICM's at the time, and they sent him headshots of me, and He this was sort of unconventional. He apparently wrote 16 candles over a weekend with my headshot up on the bulletin board. And then when it was time to cast it, Universal decided to cast that and do that movie before The Breakfast Club, which he was in the middle of casting locally in Chicago. And so when it came time to cast this movie, he said, "Well, I want to meet the girl that's in that headshot." And so they set up a meeting, and we just hit it off.
Well, you hadn't done films before. You had done commercials?
No, I had done films. I was in The Tempest by Paul Mazursky. I played John Cassavetes' daughter and Jenna Rollins' daughter.
Oh.
My first movie with Susan Sarandon and Raul Julia and Vittorio Gassman.
And you'd also been singing by that time?
I had been singing since I was 3 and a half with my father's jazz band. And that's always what I thought I was going to do until I became interested by acting.
And now you've recorded something as a jazz singer. So I guess everything comes around to where it should have been from the first.
Exactly, just like hair color. You should always go back. No, I really, it's one of the themes of my book is figuring out what really matters to you, you know, what in your core self, and getting to this place in your life and figuring out, well, how far am I away from what I wanted to do? And did I veer from that because I decided that I wanted something different, or because sort of life took me in different directions and I can't find my way back? And I think that that's a really important theme. And I mean, it really resonates in my life.
You wrote that although you'd felt very close to John Hughes while you were working together, you believed that he'd been holding a grudge against you and that you hadn't seen him for some 20 years before his death. Why would he have held a grudge against you?
Well, I mentioned that he had a very heavy heart. He was very sensitive. And I think it was difficult to deal with us growing up, really. I think me, and when I talk about us, I'm talking about me and Anthony Michael Hall, who was my co-star in a lot of the movies that I did with him. And we were sort of, as I wrote, we were kind of avatars for him. And I think the fact that we grew up was a little bit difficult for him. I don't really think that it was a grudge so much as, you know, he held on to things a lot.
Well, he withdrew from public life in 1994, perhaps because of the same thing. Maybe he was feeling uncomfortable about making those kinds of movies, didn't know how to do anything else.
Well, he went on after the movies that I made with him and made very, very successful movies like, you know, Home Alone and Transplanted and Automobiles. And,
you know, Home Alone is about a younger kid.
Mm-hmm. You know, they were a lot broader. I don't think that they were as personal as the movies that I made with him, but, you know, very successful. But eventually he just, I don't think he even wanted to do that. I think he felt very uncomfortable in Hollywood and moved back to Chicago and really had a pretty quiet life.
And did that surprise you?
No, not really. You know, knowing him as I did and knowing that he had mixed feelings about Hollywood, it didn't surprise me that he would want to withdraw.
My guest is Molly Ringwald, who's written a book called Getting the Pretty Back, Friendship, Family, and Finding the Perfect Lipstick, with illustrations by Ruben Toledo. And it's published by It Books. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us.
So take my hand and take my heart. It's time for us to start forever. I just want to be with you.
We're back with Molly Ringwald. And actually, we're listening to Molly Ringwald from an album that was released just about a year ago.
That's right.
Called Here It Comes. She has a new book called Getting the Pretty Back. And its subtitle is Friendship, Family, and Finding the Perfect Lipstick. It has illustrations by Ruben Toledo, and it's published by It Books. Tell me more about the record. First of all, that's an original song, isn't it?
That's an original song that I wrote with Peter Smith, and that's on Peter Smith's album. It's funny listening to it because I was so incredibly pregnant when I recorded that. And you can kind of hear it. I'm a little bit stuffy because you tend to get a little stuffy when you're pregnant.
Because you have a big belly, your nose gets stuffed up?
Yeah, everything. You would not believe what happens to you when you're pregnant. But that's a song that I wrote with him called I Just Want to Be With You. And we just got through. So that's on his album, along with a song called I'll Take Romance, written by Oscar Hammerstein. And then we just got
through.
While
my heart is young and eager and gay.
Yes, that's right. we just got through recording my album, and we're mastering those songs right now. And that should be probably out sometime in the fall.
You mentioned being pregnant. Your first husband was French. You were living in Paris when you met him?
I was, yes.
But you didn't have children?
No, I did not. Not with him.
You've written that that when the marriage ended, you were 33 years old, and because of the timing, you were afraid that you never would have children.
I was. I had a late-term miscarriage, which I also write about in the book a little bit, which was just devastating. You never know why those things happen, and they never really could figure out exactly why that happened. It just did. And at the same time, my marriage was ending, and it was a strange time because I thought, yeah, I didn't know if I was ever going to be able to have kids. And, you know, when you end this long relationship, you think, what are the chances of meeting Mr. Right right now and having kids?
Why were you in France? Were you tired of being hounded by the photographers because you had been a member of the so-called Brat Pack, and the paparazzi could get rather aggressive in pursuing you? Were you trying to escape that?
I don't think that I was trying to escape as much as I found myself somewhere that was very inspirational to me. I had been in Los Angeles and I don't think I was very happy or inspired by anything. And I wasn't really loving the scripts that I was reading. And I'd been working for a really long time. And I thought once I found myself in Paris, I thought, why not just move here? I'm happy. Everything is beautiful. And I can work on my French because I'd never really mastered my French, although I took it in high school. So I thought if I'm ever going to do this, now is the time to do it.
Did people recognize you on the streets of Paris? Because I'm sure they've seen the John Hughes films as well.
Yeah, they did. But, you know, I don't have the same fan base in France that I do in America. And if they do recognize you, the French are way too cool for school to mention it, usually. I got recognized more by Americans, or English people that were there on vacation. But for the most part, I feel like I just kind of blended in.
There are some Americans who've done well in French films. Jean Seberg got her career started, really, in a big way in France. Mm-hmm. Did you do any French films?
I did. I did a film called Enfant du Salaud with a really wonderful, well-known French actresses, Nathalie Baye and Annie Moen and François Cluzet and Jean Yen. But for me, even though my accent is good in French, I'm still required in a way to play the American girl or the English girl. And so I think I just felt a little bit limited in what I could do. And doing that movie, once I did it, I felt like it gave me the desire to go back and work in English.
So how did you meet your current husband?
We met through a mutual friend in New York City. Actually, I write about it in my book.
That's why I'm asking you.
We met because a friend of mine started this kind of pre-Facebook, pre-MySpace sort of online literary salon, mostly writers or bookish people and Panio, my husband, was an editor at Bloomsbury at the time, and he sent in a contribution. Everyone was supposed to sort of write about what they were listening to, reading, or, you know, a book of poetry or a piece of graffiti or anything that was sort of inspiring. And he sent in a passage from John Cheever's Goodbye, My Brother, the last paragraph. And I'd never read Cheever. And so I wrote to him and I said, this is beautiful. And then he wrote me back and we sort of wrote back and forth to each other for 6 months until we finally met face to face.
And then you realized that this was it? Because you mentioned Mr. Wright before.
Yeah, I don't know that I...
One of those weird fantasies.
I don't know that I said this is it, but I said this is something.
And it was okay with him to have children?
Well, he wanted to have children, but his timetable was a little different than mine because he is 7 years younger than me. So when I asked him when he wanted to have children, he said, oh, probably sometime in my 40s.
Which would have been impossible. Yeah. How many kids do you wind up having?
Three. I have a six-year-old. We have a six-year-old together, and then we just had twins 9 months ago.
Wow. Although you wanted to be married and have children, you've included a section in your book about the joys of staying single.
That's right. Well, I wanted to make sure that the book, you know, it's really written for everyone, mostly for women, I think, because, you know, this is my first book, and they always say that you should write about what you know, and that's what I know. It's being a woman. So it's, you know, the woman's experience. But I didn't want it just to be, you know, you have to be married and a mother in order to enjoy this book, because there's been times where I've been single in my life and really loved it.
Do you, is it possible to make friends in the business? I mentioned the Brat Pack earlier. The Academy Awards reunited most of the cast of The Breakfast Club. You were joined by Anthony Michael Hall, Ally Sheedy, Judd Nelson. Only Emilio Estevez, who was a guest on the show to talk about Bobby, the movie he directed, didn't attend. And then that group of actors, along with Matthew Broderick, Macaulay Culkin, Demi Moore, became known as the Brat Pack during the 1980s. Have you remained friends, or were you really friends, in fact?
That's a good question. I think we were friendly.
Because there is, in the past, we often heard about the studios. There are no studios anymore, but the studios putting people together, kind of giving the impression for the fans that they were dating or they were going to get married. Yeah. Sometimes they never even saw each other.
Yeah, well, I think that was sort of in the golden age of Hollywood. That was done a lot more than when I started doing movies in the 80s. I think a lot of the actors were good friends. You know, I know that Rob Lowe and Emilio and Sean Penn grew up close together in Malibu, and they hung out together a lot. But, you know, I was actually a lot younger than my co-stars. Anthony Michael Hall and I were the only ones that were actually the ages that we were playing. So I couldn't really be friends because my life was still at home. I couldn't go out and carouse the way that they were, which was maybe not such a bad thing.
I wonder, given your experiences, how do you feel about allowing your own children to work in show business? Is this something you've discussed with your husband?
Yeah, we talk about it.
Because you went in really young, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. My parents didn't have any experience at all, really, in show business. My dad's a jazz musician, which is quite different than the film business. So they really didn't know what it was about. They were somewhat naive. And, you know, it is a business. And even though I had a lot of success, you know, it's not an easy business for anyone, particularly a child who's still developing. And I really, you know, even though I turned out all right, I really want to make sure that my kids get to discover a lot about themselves, and then they decide on their own when they're older.
Well, you say that your parents did a great job looking out for you when you were young, about telling you which types of roles would be best for you.
Mm-hmm.
But do you regret the fact that would have meant you wouldn't have appeared in a film like Blue Velvet?
I understand why they made that decision, and I don't fault them for that. I think that it's a great movie, and, you know, I enjoyed watching it, but I understand why my mom was reluctant to have me do that, and I respect that. You know, I think they had mixed feelings by that point, but I had already sort of become famous, and I already had a career, and I think that they were just trying to protect me as much as they could. They didn't want me to do movies about things that I didn't really necessarily know about in my own life, and I think that that's why they made that decision for me.
Although all of the movies that you made with John Hughes are still popular, it seems to me that The Breakfast Club has become almost a cult classic. Mm-hmm. What happens there? Are there really cult screenings where they want you to attend?
I don't know about any cult screenings. I haven't seen the movie actually all the way through for such a long time because I've sort of been waiting in a way to watch all of them with my daughter. Because like I said, she's 6 years old and she's too young to watch them now. And I want to wait until she's older and watch them all together.
Although they're not the kinds of films that you'd be embarrassed about showing your daughter. I've spoken to a couple of actresses who said, you know, I asked them why they made a certain film. They said, well, I wanted to make a film that my kids could see me in because the other ones would have been a problem.
Yeah, I think that, you know, every kid in America eventually watches the movies. I mean, these movies, Breakfast Club is you know, it's taught in schools. And, you know, when teachers want to talk about, you know, with kids and about communication, you know, they screen this movie. So I think it's something that she'll really get a lot out of. But I just want to make sure that she's old enough to understand.
Well, you're doing the television show. You have this book. Are you also performing at jazz clubs?
I am. Well, I haven't lately because I've just been too busy, but I am performing actually at a jazz festival in Sacramento this May, which is my hometown.
You have all sorts of interesting bits of advice. You say that readers should get caught up in the underwear rut. That is,
yeah.
That is, you shouldn't start wearing very interesting underwear when you get older.
Well, I you know, that's pretty much talking about how important it is to pay attention to yourself. And just because other people can't see it, it matters to you. It's like having a secret on underneath.
Molly Ringwald will be appearing at Bookend in Ridgewood, New Jersey tonight at 7 o'clock. She'll be signing books. The book we're talking about is Getting the Pretty Back. The Pretty Back?
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever lose it?
Well, I kind of felt that I did. You know, the way that I define pretty is really more of an attitude and a lightness that you tend to lose as life takes you in different directions. So I think we all lose the pretty at some point, but you can always get it back.
The subtitle is Friendship, Family, and Finding the Perfect Lipstick. There are illustrations by Ruben Toledo. And it's published by It Books. And I want to thank Molly Ringwald for being my guest today on the show. It's been a lot of fun talking with you.
Thank you.